Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, brought to you by the Orthodox Union Israel Center in Jerusalem. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Toledot. It is Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 29th and last day of Cheshvan. Tonight, tomorrow is Rosh Chodesh Kislev. December has a one-day jump on Kislev this year. Today is December 1st, and it will be next month that the secular and Jewish dates will be in sync. That, of course, has no halachic significance, but it's still a fun kind of situation. And coming around to Tevet in January, we'll talk about how often it happens, etc., etc. Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed. Shir ha-ma'alot, mima'amakim karaticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli, tihiyena oznecha kashivot l'kol tachanunai. Imavono tishmoria Adonai mi'amod. Ki imacha ha-slicha lama'an tivi. Ki viti Adonai kiveta nafshi v'lidvoro ho-cholti. Nafshi l'Adonai, mi shomerim la-boker, shomerim la-boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael, mikol avonotav.
Yisrael Anesuvanim Matzora Uvishivya
Leora Mishibu
That was Paul Glasser, who made this recording many, many, many years ago. It's the earliest Achenu that I could remember. There have been many nice Achenus since then, but this has always been my favorite. The album is called Mizmor Shir. We're talking back in the early 70s, I guess. Someone else was singing the Achenu on that album, except for the end, the deeper voice. That was Paul's. He spent many, many years at Yeshiva University, and now he's working with Shaarei Tzedek in the States. If I have time a little later, I hope to talk about Rosh Chodesh, and I'll mention Kiddush Levana as well. But let's get into Toledot. First of all, in case it sounds strange to hear the name of the Sedra Toledot rather than Toldot, it's one of my grammar pronunciation hang-ups that I've developed in the last number of years, and that is to pay attention to the distinction between a shvanach and a shvana. Shulchan, table. Shul, lamid, has a shvanach under it. Therefore, there is no vowel sound, it's just the consonant sound of the lamid. Shul, shul, shulchan. The nun, by the way, even though it's the last letter and doesn't have a vowel, has the equivalent of a shvanach. Shul Chan. Neither the Lamed nor the Nun contribute a vowel sound, just their consonant sound, to the pronunciation of the word. Shema Yisrael. Shema. Under the Shin is a Shvana. It has a very short vowel sound. You should not say Shema, but Shema. Maybe that's not the best example. Take the word for your nation, your people. Ammecha. Not Amcha. Ammecha. Amcha would be a shvanach. Like Shimcha. That's correct. Shimcha, your name. Under the mem is a shvanach. A resting shva does not have a vowel sound. First syllable is Shim. And the second syllable, cha. Ammecha, there's a dagesh chazak in the mem, let's not get into that, but the vowel under the mem in ammecha is a shvana. A shvana has a short vowel sound, so it's not amcha, but it's ammecha. Toledot, first syllable, to. Tuf, cholam, by itself. The lamed with the shva belongs to the dot syllable, and therefore the word is properly pronounced to ledot. Ele to ledot. With that said, when a person talks about the sedra, especially if you're talking in English, the sedra is toldot, or toldos. But the real word, the one that you're supposed to use when you're reading the Torah, is to ledot. And there are many examples of that in our davening, and one should be careful about those pronunciations. With that said, I will probably refer to the Sedra many times as Toldos, but if this makes any sense, the real word is Toledot, and the way people talk is Toldos. Observation. Well known. Avraham Avinu had a brother, Nachor. He had another brother, Haran, who had died before. Let's look at Avraham and his brother Nachor. Nachor, the Torah tells us, had 12 children. That seems to be a certain completeness to one's next generation. Not that I'm recommending 12 children for everybody, but, you know, a nice round even dozen. And it seems to be because later when we become 12 tribes, that number is repeated. But let's go back. Nachor has 12 children. Avraham has no children. Then God says, you will have a son. And because Sarah was not able to conceive at the time, Avraham was given Hagar by Sarah, and Hagar became pregnant and gave birth to Ishmael. Then Avraham might have thought that that was the son he was promised. God assures him that Sarah will have a child, and it will be that child who you will name Yitzchak, and Yitzchak will be the one to be your spiritual heir. Ishmael, the Torah tells us, had 12 children. But Yitzchak, his half-brother, we'll call him? No. Yitzchak went for 20 years of marriage without a child, and then, at the beginning of Parshat Toledot, Rivka becomes pregnant after Yitzchak and Rivka pray, and Rivka is told she is carrying twins. So, with Avraham and his brother Nachor, with Avraham's two children, sort of, Yishmael and Yitzchak, things are getting closer together, the us and them in the Avraham and Nachor scenario were further apart. The us and them of Avraham's sons, Yishmael and Yitzchak, are closer. The us and them of Yaakov and Esav are even closer still. And Avraham, so to speak, finally gets his 12 children next week in Parshat Vayetze, through not him, not his son, but his son's son, Yaakov's fathering of the 12 tribes. There's something in there. I'm making it just as an observation, but there's definitely something in there. The process by which others had their 12 children, and therefore their fruitfulness and multiplyingness was easier in the case of Nachor, and in the case of Yishmael, and in the case of Esav. Not so with Avraham, very, very tough. Yitzchak, also tough. And Yaakov, finally, after struggles as well. There's definitely a message in there. I want to now get to a topic which is near and dear to my heart. I definitely have spoken about it in the past, even on Torah Tidbits Audio. But I want to explore it again. A, for those who haven't heard me explore this, and B, maybe to add an insight or two. I can start this several ways, but let me start it in the following way. Back in elementary school, I had a classmate, a good friend, who I am still a good friend of, who I remember yearly when we went over the business with Yaakov and Esav, first with the Bechorah, the birthright, and then with the blessings and what Yaakov did in order to get them. This person expressed his sympathy for dear Uncle Esav, who in the reading of the words in the Torah seems to be a fine, sweet guy, and he just gets picked on by his conniving brother. Case in point, towards the beginning of Parshat Toledot, Esav comes home from the field exhausted. Yaakov is cooking a lentil dish. Esav says, can I please have some? And he even used the word na, which some interpret as please. And Yaakov says, sell me your birthright. And Esav says, who needs my birthright? I'm starving to death. Let me have some of that. And they make a deal. Now, the words in the Torah can be cleverly analyzed and presented to show that it wasn't just like that, but there was something much deeper. But the words themselves definitely give one the impression that Yaakov was the plotter and Esav was the victim. Comes the Gemara and says, on that very day, the day that is spoken about at the beginning of Toledot, on that very day, Avraham Avinu died, Yitzchak became a mourner, Yaakov was preparing a mourner's dish of lentils, which is one of those foods, like an egg, like chickpea, that symbolize the cycle of life and therefore are used as a reminder of the process of death as well. And Esav did not just come home tired from the field, but on that very day he had murdered someone, he had raped an engaged woman, and had denied the essence of belief in God, and denied the concept of the revival of the dead, which is a fundamental principle of Judaism, and disgraced the firstbornship, the birthright. Now, of course, the Torah says specifically that Esav disgraced the birthright by giving it up for lentils and bread. But let's take a look at the Gemara's statement that he murdered someone and raped someone on that day. Where do you see that? So the Gemara points to key words. Esav comes home from the sadeh, the field. The word sadeh appears elsewhere in the Torah in the context of a man raping a woman. And the word ayef doesn't mean just that he was tired, but there's a pasuk, a verse in the Tanakh, that links the word ayef with rotzeach, horeg, with a killer. Now I'm going to run a risk of somebody hearing what I'm saying now and not listening through, so I'll say in advance that what I'm about to say is false. I certainly don't believe it, but it could be believed by someone who is not committed to, let's say, the whole scope of the chain of tradition and of Torah, which I'll explain in a moment. But a person could say, that's like planting evidence. That's like framing somebody. Look at the words of the written word in the Bible, in the Torah. It says, Esav came from the field, and he was tired. Vayavo Esav min hasadeh v'hu ayef. It does not say that he murdered anyone. It does not say that he raped anyone. It says he came from the field and he was tired. And if the Talmud is telling us that he was a murderer and a rapist on this terrible day of the death of Avraham, is it fair for them to take a word and look at another context and apply that context to here? And the same thing for the word ayef, and the same thing for the word sadeh. It seems to the person who just wants to read the Bible and doesn't want to hear about commentaries and doesn't want to hear about Talmud and doesn't want to hear about the oral Torah and the oral tradition, it seems that accusing Esav of having been a murderer and a rapist and a disbeliever on that very same day is meant to put Yaakov's deed in a positive light and to take away our sympathy from Esav, the victim. I really hope I haven't convinced anybody of that, because I don't believe it for a moment. What I do believe is the following. We have a written Torah, and we have an oral Torah. Written Torah and oral Torah go hand in hand. More than that, they're like Siamese twins, inseparable. The written word says Esav came from the field and he was tired. The oral Torah teaches us that he was a murderer and a rapist and a denier of God. How do we know that? We are taught that by the oral Torah. How do we prove it? We are taught that by the oral Torah. Does it prove anything that the words sadeh and ayef are used? I don't think so. That's just a hint. It's a hint to the truth of not only the written word, but the oral word as well. This is not a hatchet job on Esav. This is the full picture. Esav was a Rasha. He did not want any of the spiritual responsibility of the birthright, and he gladly gave up the birthright. He did not deserve the bracha from Yitzchak, the blessing from Yitzchak, even though Yitzchak had hoped, according to some of the commentaries, that this might turn Esav in a good direction. He should not and did not receive that blessing. I believe this same idea of the written word of Torah only containing part of the story, which needs to be fleshed out by the oral law, which is not the figment of human imagination, but is divine, We see many, many examples of this, not only in a story context, as I am applying it to Yaakov and Esav, but in a halachic context as well, Jewish law. What does Jewish law have to say about milk and meat? Better yet, what does Torah have to say about milk and meat? A person who reads only the Torah, only the written word, does not have a commitment towards the inseparable nature of the written word and the oral law. He will answer that question, what does the Torah say about milk and meat? That one may not cook a gedi, let's call it a baby goat, in its mother's milk. That's what the written word says about basar b'chalav. And that's how some people will answer the question, what does the Torah have to say about milk and meat? A person who understands and values the connection between the written word and the oral law will say the Torah forbids the cooking of the meat of cow, goat, and sheep with the milk of cow, goat, and sheep, regardless of any relationship between the source of the meat and the source of the milk. It forbids the eating of those mixtures, and it forbids the deriving of benefit from those mixtures. So someone will say, but wait a minute, it doesn't say that in the Torah. I didn't say it said it in the written word. You asked me what the Torah says. The Torah is the combination of Torah Shebichtav, the written word, and Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral Torah. Sauteing lamb chops in butter that came from the milk of a cow is not a rabbinic derivation, legislation, interpretation of the Torah's prohibition. It is a violation of the Torah's prohibition. Sauteing lamb chops in butter is an equal prohibition to poaching baby goat meat in its own mother's milk. I used a halachic example of the laws of milk and meat. It goes the same for, or more or less the same, we'll say, for the Agadic storyline of the Torah. That Esav was a Rasha, that on the day that Avraham died, he committed a murder and a rape, is not conjecture. It is not, as I said before, the imagination of some kind of Jewish scholar who was looking to shine this negative light on it. It was the tradition passed down through the generations as part of that body of oral Torah. What about the play on the word Sadeh and the word Ayef? I don't know. That could have been part of the tradition. It could have been the creation of an individual being armed with both the written word and the story, so to speak, that was passed down. The best I could do there is equivocate a little. One of the questions that this raises is, why? Why did God say baby goat in its mother's milk and then explain to Moshe the laws of milk and meat? Why did God choose to write in the Torah that Esav returned from the field and he was exhausted when the Torah in writing could have done otherwise? I don't know if I have all the answers, or let's say I certainly don't have all the answers. I might have a personal handle on one of the ideas. Let's go back to the milk and meat example. There's a medrash from a book called Medrash Peliah, wondrous medrash, that says the following. When God dictated to Moshe, Lo tevashel gedi b'chalev imo, thou shalt not seethe a goat in its mother's milk, upiresh lo dine basar b'chalev, and he explained to Moshe and instructed him to transmit to the people the laws of milk and meat, Moshe Rabbeinu asked God's permission to write milk and meat, or meat in milk. In other words, my interpretation, sensing that the phrase, Gedi b'chalev imo, is too cryptic, Moshe said, after hearing the explanation of what's included in the prohibition of milk and meat, let me write that. Let me write the words, basar b'chalav, they'll be easier to understand. The Medrash continues, Omar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God said to him, Ketav lecha et hadvarim ha'ela, write these words. Ki al pi hadvarim ha'ela, karati itcha brit ve'et Yisrael. Because based on the words of the Torah, I have made my covenant with you and with Israel. Certainly different ways to interpret that statement, but I have an idea which I'll share with you after we listen to Ein Aruch Lecha by Michael Streicher. This has become, at least here in Israel, could be in the States as well, a popular Shabbos morning tune preceding Kel Adon and then taking over Kel Adon. This original piece by Michael Streicher is just the Ein Aruch Lecha portion. And then, I don't know who developed the idea of continuing the same tune into Kel Adon, but as I said, it's kind of popular here in Israel. But this, as far as I know, is the original. Michael Streicher with Ein Aruch Lecha.
Las khamal keyu hay le khaye wa yuna mabo hey na rois lakha ashem la keyu bo 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 hay na bo hay na mase de ye zulas kha zulas khama keyu hay le khaye Oy la mabo, oy ebezil tichon, kama boya meinu, liyigoy samoshia.
transmission of Torah, and really transmission of any knowledge, is best served with a text around which you can work, and a teacher transmitting to a student. Parent to child, teacher to student, Rebbe to Talmud, is the way that the Torah was always meant to be of necessity transmitted from one generation to the next. Not, here's the scroll, go study it yourself. It's not supposed to be like that, and it shouldn't be like that. If that is so, and I believe it is, then you do not write everything in a parchment, in a book. What you do is write that which will serve as an anchor, a guideline, an outline, a structure to which you will attach the oral teachings of your teacher. Imagine, if you will, a professor at a university gives lectures and there are notes circulated from those lectures. A person who did not attend the lecture picks up this set of notes and says, I understood 10% of this. I can't make heads or tails out of the rest. Ah, says someone, these notes go along with having attended the lecture. If you attended the lecture and you read these notes, you'll remember and understand what went on. These notes alone are not understandable without the oral transmission. There are other notes that could be a verbatim transcription of a lecture, and those will be understandable without notes, but they will be subject to making mistakes. You will read it, you will say, I've got the entire text of the lecture, so obviously it's all here. And the answer was, no, it isn't, because you have to understand it, you have to pick up nuances, you have to be able to ask a question, get an answer, and that keeps it fresh, and that keeps it true. And that's the process of Torah Shebichtav and Torah Sheba'alpeh, the written word and the oral law. I think that lecture and notes is a decent mushel, a decent analogy. Here's one that's not as good, but it works also. Ask someone a question about a book he's reading and get an answer. And then someone says, what are you talking about? On page 53, it's exactly the opposite. And you'll see that when you get up to it. So how do you expect to answer questions about the book if all you read is the first couple of chapters? How can you answer questions about Torah if all you read is the written word? This is what the world did. The world took Torah from the Jewish people. The written word forced Jewish scholars to translate the words of the Torah into Greek. From there, translated into other languages, to the point where the Bible is the all-time most translated work in the history of the world. Second, I once read, is, believe it or not, Reader's Digest, and Harry Potter is coming up on number 3. But I don't think either of them will reach the magnitude of the Bible. But the problem with that was, the world took the written word and did not ask for or did not get the oral tradition. So there are going to be misunderstandings and misinterpretations and perversions of the Torah, and we have suffered many of them. One of the most glaring examples is an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. If that's what the Bible says, then the Bible comes across as being very barbaric and brutal. When if you look at any of the parts of the oral Torah, they tell you this was never meant by God to be literal. It was meant for effect, to emphasize the seriousness of the issue, but it was monetary compensation that was intended. Do not, God forbid, think that people were embarrassed by the Torah's brutality of an eye for an eye and came up with this on their own. This is the meaning of that phrase, monetary compensation. Again, the question is, why put it in those terms? And, as I started to say before, part of the answer is to guarantee that a person cannot read and understand the Torah on his own. He must link himself to a chain of tradition. You do it by yourself, you're going to get it wrong. You'll pervert what the Torah means. You're listening to Torah Tidbits Audio for Parshat Toledot. Let me throw in a Mishnah, which I've also mentioned in the past in different context, and I think it belongs here as well. There's a Mishnah in Chagiga, which speaks of mitzvot that have different amounts of text in the written word. It starts out by mentioning Hatarat Nidarim, the nullification of vows, which it says is floating in the air. There is no concrete text to see the mitzvah of and the details of Hatarat Nidarim, nullification of vows. Yet we have a tradition and a whole body of laws related to it that this is part of Torah. So the Mishnah describes it as floating in the air. It then talks about Shabbat, among other mitzvot, as a mountain hanging by a hair, or as we might say in English, by a thread. Meaning, and the Mishnah explains, voluminous material and myriads of details, relatively little text. And then it speaks of mitzvot that have very concrete text to anchor their body of mitzvot, like the laws of Tuma and Tahara, the laws of Korbanot, sacrifices in the Beit HaMikdash. The Mishnah's point is that these and those and the other ones are all part of the body of Halacha. It doesn't matter whether you have something that is firmly anchored and expressed in the text, or you have something that's obscurely referred to, or generalized, or hinted at, or not even mentioned. If we have a tradition that it is part of Torah, it is part of Torah. No less than Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim ve'et haaretz, that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Now, to be sure, a sect, be it Jewish or non-Jewish, that rejects the oral tradition is going to come to different conclusions. They're going to say, Hatarat Nedarim, nullification of vows, ain't no such thing. Show me where it says. I had a guy once, I'm not saying he was a member of one of these sects, but he was doing it to needle me, comes into the office, tucked under his arm is a Bible, the King James Version no less, and he said, I see that you give a class in the laws of milk and meat. I don't have time to attend the class. I was wondering if you could tell me what the Torah says about milk and meat. Oh, and before you answer, he says to me, don't tell me Talmud, and don't tell me Rashi, and don't tell me Shulchan Aruch, just what the Torah says. I said, there's my door. Close it on your way out. He was not coming with a sincere question. He was coming to challenge the fact that there is a whole body of law related to milk and meat that is built upon a foundation of three identical phrases in the Torah from three different places that says, Lo tevashel gedi b'chalev imo. Our tradition, and equally importantly, our confidence in that tradition, makes me able to say, this is the truth of Torah. You put the tefillin of the head on your head at the edge of the hairline, former hairline, in the center, which is what the Torah means when it says, put them bein einecha, between your eyes. The bridge of your nose is physically between your eyes, but if you put the tefillin of the head there, you are distorting the meaning of the Torah. Interesting to be able to say that. Because it seems that not putting it on the bridge of the nose, but putting it on the head, is a distortion of the words. Read the words, Bein Einecha. Go into the street, stop 100 people at random, say you're doing a survey, take the tip of your right hand index finger, and touch it to the spot on your face called Bein Einecha. 99 out of 100 people or more will put their fingertip on the bridge of their nose. that is not Bein Einecha. Esav was not a victim of a conniving Yaakov. It just isn't the truth. Who says it's not the truth? Moshe kibel Torah misinai umasar Yehoshua, etc., etc. Moshe received the Torah at Sinai and transmitted it to the people. There is a powerful, strong chain of tradition that says that Esav was a Rasha, that says that milk and meat prohibitions apply to the cooking of cow, goat, and sheep in the milk of cow, goat, and sheep. There is a tradition that defines Jewish law, Jewish life, and Jewish history. Okay, let's change gears a little, and to help us, we'll still stay in Toledot, but we'll go to a different aspect of the Sedra. Let's hear from Mendy Wald with Kishem She'ani, part of the passages that are said as part of Kiddush Levana, the bracha in the presence of the moon. The earliest opportunity this month will be Sunday night coming up. That's for those who follow the Minhag Yerushalayim, the Vilna Gaon's Minhag of 3 days after the Molad. You could already say Kiddush Levana. Those that insist on waiting a full 7 days after the birth of the new moon will have their first opportunity next Thursday night. One should not wait around for then unless it is a firm practice of yours to do the 7 day minhag, especially during the winter time when many nights can be cloudy and one risks missing out on this very precious mitzvah. Mendy Wald with Kishem.
Yeah.
Running out of time faster than I thought, let me just finish with the following idea. The fact that Yaakov deserved the spiritual part of the Bechorah, the fact that Yaakov was the true intended recipient of the blessings, does not change the fact that Yaakov was to suffer for the deceit of his father. It is so obvious when we look at how the brothers deceived Yaakov by taking a goat and slaughtering it and putting the blood on Yosef's garment. Bing, bing, bing. What rings out is the fact that it was Esav's garment and the skin of a goat that Yaakov used at Rivka's instruction and justifiably, but used those items to deceive Yitzchak. He had to do it. There are some that actually say that this was a prophecy, which means instructions from God to Rivka to tell Yaakov to do that, but he still suffered the consequences. And it's not just Yaakov. It's all of the people of Israel, because the major animal of the Korban Chatat, the sin offering, is the goat. Communal Chatat and personal Chatat. Think about that. We can even generalize and say that the Avot and Imahot did not really have very calm, comfortable lives, and they sacrificed for the sake of their children, who are us. Jumping again to another subject, and I'd just like to say to the people who are listening on OU Radio, this show, Torah Tidbits Audio, had been on Arut Sheva for about 8 years, and that includes on the actual radio when they were able to broadcast, and then simultaneously on the internet, and now exclusively on the internet. It started on OU Radio a number of months ago, but it continues on Israel National Radio, which is the Arut Sheva website. Because Torah Tibbetz Audio is part of their, what they call, live stream, it has a very restricted time frame. The first half, or the first part of the show, is 23 minutes, not a second less, not a second more. The second segment is 26 minutes, and what I do that first because I have a deadline of when it is first put out on the internet. Then I take the two halves, I strip off the I'll be right back, you know, after the news update, because you don't have a news update on OU Radio. And I try to seam the two parts together. I then have the opportunity to knock off the end piece and continue without that sense of, oh, time's up, gotta go, and then finish off with the final music. So the pieces that you're listening to now are not necessarily on the Arut Sheva version. In fact, the OU Radio version always has more, often another song in addition to other Divrei Torah. So if you don't know which one to listen to, it might not be a bad idea to listen to the Torah Tidbits Audio on OU Radio, because you'll get more than you will if you listen to it on Israel National Radio. But don't have to tell them I said so, because I like them also. Just a few additional points about Toldot. One of which, I mean, these might be well known, but there are people who are listening that might not have heard them before. It's very significant that after Yaakov supposedly tricks his father into giving him the blessing instead of Esav, Yaakov is called by Yitzchak, specifically him, Vayikra Yitzchak El Yaakov Vayivarech Oto, and he blessed him. This is after that portion where Yitzchak could have been angry at him, but he wasn't. He knew that he was to get the bracha, and this was another bracha that also had to go to Yaakov. First, he gives him instructions, go to Padan Aram, to the home of Betuel, the father of your mother, and take from there a wife from the daughters of Lavan, your uncle. V'kel shakai yivarechotcha, and may God bless you, and you shall be fruitful and multiply, and you will be as a kahal amim. V'yitain lecha et birkat Avraham, and God should give you the blessing of Abraham. In other words, Avraham's bracha goes to Yitzchak. Yitzchak transmits it to Yaakov, not to Yishmael, not to Esav, but from Avraham to Yitzchak, to Yaakov, to the Jewish people. Lecha ulezaracha itach, lerishtecha et eretz migurecha, asher natan Elokim laAvraham. In order to acquire the land, meaning Eretz Yisrael, that God gave to Avraham and his descendants. Very significant, as we would say in Hebrew, ma'od significant. I'm kidding. Another thing to look for is the fact that Rivka, who knew that Esav wanted to kill Yaakov, did not tell Yitzchak about that. Instead, can't say she concocted a story because it was true, but she approached Yitzchak to send Yaakov away because she didn't want him to marry one of the local Canaanite women. And this was very legitimate, and Rivka agreed, and Yitzchak agreed, and so they sent away Yaakov, but ostensibly without having to tell Yitzchak that Esav was the bad guy. One other point is that as wicked as Esav is, and we see it from various parts of the Gemara and Midrashim, the Gemara compliments him for being extremely respectful of his father. Kibud Avoim, it is actually said that no one ever honored his father as greatly as Esav honored Yitzchak. In fact, some of the commentaries say that this is what scared Yaakov, because Yaakov needed merit in order to survive the attack of Esav, and he was afraid that Esav might have won the merit to be able to carry out his goal, and Baruch Hashem, he wasn't able to carry it out. However, he did say to his grandson, named Amalek, that he wanted him to continue the job of attacking Yaakov and his descendants, specifically because Esav was not able to vanquish Yaakov. If you got all that, and there's plenty to think about and talk about over Shabbat, let me finish by wishing everyone a Chodesh Tov, since it is already Rosh Chodesh Kislev here in Israel, even if you're listening to this when it's still Erev Rosh Chodesh in Chutz La'aretz. These words that I am speaking now are actually on Rosh Chodesh itself. So the wishes of Chodesh Tov, have a good month, and in Romanian, Luna Buna. And of course, Shabbat Shalom. I say Rosh Chodesh first because Shabbat, Rosh Chodesh is Friday. Shabbat is Shabbat. Surprise. But the wishes come as a pair. Chodesh Tov and Shabbat Shalom. And Lehishtameah. And we'll finish the show by Avraham Fried, which has both David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam and Simon Tov U'Mazel Tov, two parts of Kiddush Levana. Earlier we had Kishem Shani Rokeg Kenegdech. This will go hand in hand with the wishes for a good month. Avraham Fried. Oh, That was Avraham Fried, and if you're still listening, I got a story for you. Last week, Parshat Chaye Sarah, on the Parsha Picks, which is not really all puzzles, it's mostly graphics that describe many of the elements of the Parsha on Shavua. It's available in the hard copy of Torah Tidbits. It's also downloadable from the website, www.ou.org/Torah, with an H, /TT. And you can not only download it from there, you could also subscribe and get it by email. And it's a very nice tool to sit with children and guests on the Shabbos table and go over the different elements from the Parsha using these graphic things. They do sometimes contain cryptic plays on words and visual puzzles, and those become a challenge for older children as well as adults. In any event, last week, Chaye Sarah, there was a badge that had the word control and the number 99. This was a reference to Barbara Felden's role on Get Smart, which was Agent 99, Control being the organization that they worked for, and the reference was to the Hebrew feminine form for agent, which is Sochenet, which was mentioned twice in the Haftorah in reference to Avishag the Shunammit. I needed to look on the internet for a good website for Get Smart, because I had a question as to what control stood for. I thought it was initials. Turns out that it doesn't stand for anything, it's just a word. But I found this wonderful website, which is called wouldyoubelieve.com, and it's by far the most extensive website for Get Smart. For anyone who remembers the show and would enjoy reminiscing, you've got it all there. So I decided to write an email message to the person who puts out the site, one fellow, and even though he claims to have had 3 million visitors to the website in the last couple of months, he still answered my email quite promptly. I told him, not knowing whether he would understand what I was talking about, I told him about the use of Control 99 as a word, as a visual puzzle. And I also told him a different story, and that goes back to the days in Yeshiva University, which was right at the time of the popularity of Get Smart. And I remember once sitting in Shiur, and the Rebbe referred to the Vilna Gaon by his acronym, the Gra. And I turned to my Chavrusa and I said, the Gra? And he said, not the Gra, the Gra. If you know what I'm talking about, fine. If not, also fine. But 35 years later, the two of us are still doing that, the Gra, not the Gra, the Gra, and we still get a good laugh out of it. And therefore, I included that story to this fellow who put up the website, Would You Believe? His answer didn't really indicate to me if he understood what I was talking about, but he said he was glad to see Get Smart get into everyday life, even so many, many years after the show. On that note, I will this time wish you one more time Chodesh Tov, Shabbat Shalom, and L'Hishtameah.
Missed it by that much.